behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
Ahoy. I'm kidding. Hi, I'm Ben.
Ahoy. Oh, I didn't expect that at all.
Oh, man. Yeah, we're going to have a lot of unexpected stuff in this episode. As of course you know, we are accompanied by our super producer, Dylan Fagan. We'll see which name he ends up with today, and as well as Noel, the Madman Brown. I don't know if Noel approves of me insisting on calling him the Madman, but it feels cool.
He has never really, like, voiced any objection, you know? Has he?
Right. No, so, I don't think so.
I guess then he consents.
I guess then, too.
Yeah.
We'll have to follow up on that. If, Scott, you don't see me for, like, 4 days or something, just put out some feelers. I know you've got a detective soul, so just make sure.
Got a few connections around town.
Yeah, make sure no disaster occurred to me.
Ah, disaster. Okay, well, that leads into today's topic. How fortuitous.
King of segues over here.
Yeah, nice work. But this one is a listener suggestion, and it's a good one. I know it's a disaster. A lot of these are relatively benign. Is that a good way to say it? I mean,
they could have been much worse.
That's a better way to say it. Could have been much worse. And so they were interesting to read about. So I really appreciated this one. Something that I hadn't really investigated too much prior to this. Mm-hmm. But this was a suggestion from a listener. His name is Sean F. And Sean wrote in a couple of times. In fact, this is kind of a rarity here. Sean wrote in once back in July of 2015, or 2016 rather. Wanted to hear the tale of the, remember the buried Ferrari Dino?
Oh,
the one that turned
up
in that Los Angeles backyard?
Yeah.
He wrote in and suggested that, and then also wrote in and suggested today's topic, which is the MV Cougar Ace. And he says, if you're not familiar, it's a gigantic auto carrier ship that lost stability and rolled over in the Pacific with, he lists a number of cars here, but we'll surprise you with that in a moment. A lot of cars on board, all Mazdas, back in 2006. The crew rescue and salvage of the ship is a great story, and Sean is exactly right. It's an incredible story, and there's so many levels to this that you could dig into. You dig into just the salvage operation.
Right.
You could dig into Mazda's version of this, you know, what happened. All maritime disasters, because there's more than just this one, of course, you know, with automobiles featured, I guess, or lost at sea in a way.
You could also look at some of the maritime aspects of it. When an earlier episode we did on Could I Travel the World by Cargo Ship?
Yeah.
We looked at this vast, invisible to most people, this vast network that's invisible to most people, which is absolutely the backbone of the global economy.
Yeah, it's happening all the time, all around us, and we just don't get to see what really happens here. We don't get to see the nuts and bolts of the whole thing. So, one quick thing that I want to mention here, and we'll spend a little bit of time on this, not a lot, but we'll get into the Cougar Ace in detail in a moment. I started looking back at some of these other large scale car disasters at sea, you know, to see what would come up. And some of these go all the way back. There's probably more than this. These are the ones that come up in a quick search. If you go back to 1941, you know, right at the beginning of World War II, you'll find that, you know, there was a ship that sunk in the Red Sea, and it was down there. It's been down there for 76 years now. It's still down there, but it's loaded with this huge array of old military vehicles, you know, like Bedford trucks and armored vehicles and Norton and BSA motorcycles and, of course, guns and ammunition and all that. It was sunk during World War II, right at the very beginning of World War II, really. But it was sunk while it was still anchored. And guess who discovered this thing back in 1956 or rediscovered it?
Who is this?
Jacques Cousteau.
Jacques
Cousteau rediscovered this wreck, and again, it has, like, I think it's like 120 vehicles on board or something like that. It's a huge old cargo ship that was carrying materials or military vehicles, you know, a transport vehicle from Glasgow to Alexandria, Egypt, and it was sunk in port on the way.
This is the SS Thistlegorm.
That's the one, yeah, exactly. So that's one example, and, you know, you can still dive on this today. And if you want to read about, you know, the Thistlegorm, you can read about it in Jacques Cousteau's book, because he describes, you know, again, rediscovering this in 1956 in his book called The Living Sea. So that's just one example, and that's, again, 120 vehicles. That's not a huge scale disaster like what we're talking about today, but There's others. Let's see. In 1980, there was a car ferry boat that sunk. So this isn't a manufacturer disaster. This is one that happened to, you know, just private citizens that were on a car ferry. There's something like, oh, this is the one that has 120 vehicles. Maybe the Thistlegorm doesn't have 120, but this is the one. It's called the Zenobia, and it's in Cyprus. And this one sunk during her maiden voyage back in June of 1980. And this is, of course, what, three, 4 decades later at this point? All of those cars are still down there. You can still go down and, you know, dive on this wreck if you wanted to and see, you know, exactly what's happening there. They didn't recover any of those vehicles. They left them there. Mm-hmm. In 2012, I'm just skipping around all over the place, but in 2012, there's the Baltic Ace disaster, and this is a big one. These were all Mitsubishi cars that were on board. So, again, you know, more than 1,400 vehicles were lost, 11 sailors, again, in 15 minutes. And this is happening in the North Sea. So really cold. It's December 5th in the North Sea in 2012. You can imagine, you know, that you couldn't last too long in the water in that situation.
Right.
So the rescue effort, the salvage effort for this whole thing, cost something like $73 million to bring this ship back up and all of its contents because they were worried about oil spilling into the ocean.
Right.
And it was, of course, you know, at this point. So, unfortunately, this boat was only insured for $55 million, and the operation to retrieve it cost $73 million. So, huge loss for the company in that situation, money-wise. And there's so many more of these. Let's see. 2015, so this is really recent. There was a $53 million accident that happened at sea where there were, again, all these luxury cars that were scrapped because they were on a cargo ship that simply tipped over to one side. It was tilted to one side.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens a lot. We'll find out, you know, what happens when that situation occurs. But $53 million U.S. dollars of vehicles. This is BMWs, Minis. There was some construction equipment on board. Even there was one single Rolls-Royce Wraith on board that, you know, has its own huge estimate of how much that's worth.
Yeah.
Like 1,200 Jaguar sports cars. Again, there was something like 1,300 vehicles on board the ship when it tipped over, destroying everything on board. So, again, this happens all over the place.
Right. More than you think.
Yeah, more than you would think. So, anyways, you know what? There's one other one that we should mention that's not a maritime disaster. There was one just last summer at the end of the year, I guess. It was in December of 2016, and there were BMWs that were on a train that were they were coming out of, where was it? It was Spartanburg in South Carolina, and they were headed to the port, I believe, Charleston that they were headed to. And the train derailed. There were like 12 cars that had 10 cars on each. And somewhere in Blair, South Carolina is where this thing derailed. All the vehicles on board, of course, were destroyed. These BMWs, there's something like 120 cars. Just a huge accident that included mostly the BMW X line of vehicles. So all versions of that, the X3, the X4, X5, X6. Yeah. And I think there might even have been some X7s on board, but that would have been early on in production, so maybe not. We'll have to, you know, dig into it further and see what was on board there. But nobody on the train was hurt. You know, there was only a two-man crew, and they got off without injury. So that was good. But, yeah, these types of things are happening. Every few years, you'll hear about these major disasters that occur where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of vehicles lost. And the top one of these, the biggest one that we were able to find and that Sean pointed out, is a vehicle called, or a cargo ship called, the Cougar Ace.
Yeah. Built in Japan in 1993, this monstrous cargo ship, it's 55,328 tons. 654.6 feet long. This massive ship is one of the biggest car carriers in the world. It can tote more than 5,000 cars in one go.
5,000 vehicles are a possibility on this ship. Now, it's got 14 decks. That's how it carries that many vehicles. And I think at the time that we're going to be talking about here, there was a crew of about 23 crew members.
Right.
And this would have been back around, what? This is a long time ago.
Yeah.
Relatively speaking. In 2006, I believe, is when the accident happened. And this article that we're going to kind of follow through here, it's from Car and Driver. Mm-hmm. And it's from 2008, so they kind of already know the aftermath of what had happened and, you know, what's going on. But this is an interesting tale about the accident itself, the salvage of the vehicles, and the ship itself, and then what kind of the Well, what happens after that, really? Because there's a lot of ways that Mazda could have handled this.
Right.
So where do you want to begin? Maybe we should start, you know, when it launched. How about that?
Sounds good. All right. The Cougar Ace sailed out of Hiroshima in the middle of July in 2006. They had their cargo very near capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 4,703 Mazdas. They were all 2007 model year vehicles.
Ah, here's a little side note, though. There were 109 other vehicles on board that hardly ever get mentioned.
Yeah.
And we don't even know what they are. It's just the focus is always on these Mazda vehicles. So 4,703 brand new Mazda vehicles plus 109 other vehicles. That's a huge number, by the way.
Yes. They say they're small commercial trucks, but let me just add something here,
sure.
Scott. Do you think that someone really doesn't know, I'm doing air quotes here, folks, doesn't yeah. know that what the manufacturer of those trucks would be? Or was it something that they didn't want to have in the news?
No, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it could be that, you know, they were, you know, like, not gray market cars, but maybe cars that were, oh, well, you know, we can probably speculate about this.
Military applications.
Could be.
I don't know.
I kind of doubt anything that nefarious is going
on.
I really. I think it's probably just, you know, they were shipping some cargo trucks or something. Maybe that's it.
Well, here's what happened. Whatever the identity of those small commercial truck manufacturers may have been, on July 23rd, the ship was near the Aleutians heading toward the Alaskan coast and then down toward these ports on the west coast of North America. There were three that Mazda had. Sea was relatively calm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, weather was good.
Yeah.
The engine, by the way, huge beast. Did we talk about cargo ship engines in a previous podcast?
Maybe, but we probably didn't give them enough due, really.
We talked about some of the world's largest engines, I know for sure.
Enormous diesel engines.
Right? Yeah, diesel engines. Yeah, this thing has... Scott, do you want to give them the horsepower?
Well, it's just under 16,000 horsepower, so it's massive, massive engines.
I mean,
you can imagine what it takes to push, you know, a ship like this that's, what, 660 feet long
yeah.
and weighs, what was it, 500 and some odd tons through the water, plus you know, the almost 5,000 cars, right?
Right.
All right, so enormous engines, but so what went wrong here? What happened? You think it would have run aground or something like that? That's not the case. What happened was, and I'm going to read most of this here, but
yeah.
Here's what happened. Before sailing into American waters, the U.S. has a law that requires a ship's ballast tanks to be purged of seawater that's taken on in foreign lands to avoid fouling local marine environments with non-native species. So you don't want to introduce a species that is not normally in those waters
right.
to that water, because you never know the consequences, right?
Yeah, and that makes – I know that might sound a little bit crazy for people, but if you live in an area with invasive species, then you know how problematic they can be. Like, Scott, you used to live a lot closer to the Great Lakes, and Asian carp is a huge problem there,
yeah,
right?
And zebra mussels, and you know, there's just this huge lot of concerns, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
so this isn't some namby-pamby feel-good thing. There's a real reason to have this purge, so it has to happen. But that is where the story takes a turn. Where does it lead? We'll find out right after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. And, Ben, we were just leaving off where they were dumping some of this ballast water,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And this thing has 11 stabilization tanks on board, just so you understand that, you know, there's these different compartments that can be loaded and unloaded with water so that they can take on the right amount of water to keep it level and, you know, I guess everything on keel, maybe. Is that the right way to say that?
Yeah.
I hope.
On
an even keel. That's probably the better way to say it. So whether it was a human, you know, error, like a, you know, human error or mechanical failure, they haven't said yet. But that afternoon, the water from the starboard ballast tanks was drained without being refilled simultaneously with fresh seawater. So the top-heavy ship started to keel over onto its port side. Now, the port side, of course, is the left side of the ship if you're looking from the, you know, across the bow, I guess,
yeah.
at the bow. The right side would be the starboard side. So if we throw these terms in there, if that's what they mean, I think most everybody gets that.
If you're sitting there at the center of the ship, you're facing the front, then the port is the left side.
Correct. That's right. So it starts to instantly keel over onto its port side, and It's not good for a cargo ship that's carrying, you know, a load like this, a very heavy load. It gets very top heavy. So everything that wasn't strapped down, now the cars were strapped down. That's sort of the good part at this point. That's important right now. You're right. But all the crew members started, I mean, it's tipping to the point where they're starting to slide along the decks and, you know, for fear of going off the edge. Again, 23 crew members were aboard. Lucky for them, however, there was just one person that had a broken leg. The steward, I think, broke his leg.
Yeah.
But the crew was able to put on survival gear and you know, get to the top on the starboard side. So they're at the very top of the ship. And then they had to wait 23 hours until the U.S. Coast Guard and Alaska Air National Guard helicopters could then lift them to safety. Now, that seems like a long time, but you got to remember how desolate this area is.
Well, yeah.
It's way out there. And for the Coast Guard to reach them, it probably took that long. I mean, the call went out immediately. You know, they act immediately. It takes them that long to coordinate and figure out where they are and, you know, how to get to them.
And if the vehicle – so, okay, the ship is listing close to a right angle. So they are hanging out on the side of the hull. You know what I mean?
Yeah, out in the elements, like out in – you know, just exposed to everything out there.
And this is interesting. If we could take a quick diversion, if you're okay with it.
Oh, yeah.
There's a great article – on our parent website, How Stuff Works, which answers the question about how long somebody can survive adrift in the ocean.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's depressing because really the biggest factor is going to be whether you are on something, you know, even if it's just whatever that lady was clinging to in the Titanic, or if you are the Titanic, the film, or if you are just to drift by yourself, you know, with some like with a life vest or some, I guess, a fun doodle or some water wings or something. Hopefully that won't happen. But the thing is that these guys were very, very fortunate, because if they had been just adrift, even with the survival suits that they put on, it's a very, very dangerous situation, especially even if the weather's good. We have to consider how far north they are. You know, you mentioned when that wreck occurred in the North Sea, that water at that stage makes hypothermia one of the primary concerns.
Yeah.
You know, in the movies, it's always about starvation or dehydration. But if you sink there and you're adrift somewhere, there's a very real chance that you won't be alive long enough to have those problems.
It depends where you are on the globe, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
the whole thing. Like, what latitude are you at, really?
Yeah.
That's what it comes down
to.
Yeah,
so they were pretty fortunate, actually, to get there. And, you know, I'm also wondering how they put the call out. You know?
Yeah, because you would have to climb back down to or up to the captain's area or, somewhere where they're
maybe
able to.
Maybe they had emergency radio on the suit or something.
Possibly, yeah. But yeah. Well, I wouldn't think it would be something strong enough to send out a distress signal, though. That's mostly,
That's a good point.
Ship-to-ship or person-to-person communication on the ship, probably, I would think. But anyways, we can guess about that all day.
Yeah, right.
But the reality here was that it wasn't leaking anything into the ocean. You know, it wasn't dumping fuel or anything like that. The cars weren't leaking.
And it was slowly taking on water. That's why it hadn't just capsized.
So it's drifting, right? It's drifting at this point, and they decide that, you know, the Coast Guard is going to just monitor this. They're going to leave a cutter nearby. They're going to monitor this ship because it is drifting. And after 5 days, the ship had drifted about 100 miles closer to the Aleutians. So it's getting closer and closer. They know they have to do something with it. You know, you can't just leave it like this. But here's the problem. There's still 4,700 Mazdas dangling by ropes and straps inside this vehicle. And you know, Mazda doesn't know a whole lot about this. In fact, they hardly know what's going on at all. I mean, they did say that the Coast Guard had a pretty good website that had a lot of updated information that they could access. But, you know, the ship owner, which is a company called OSK, which I believe is out of Japan, the OSK lines had contacted Mazda in Japan, and then Mazda Japan, had called, the Mazda USA, branch, I guess, and tried to let them know what's going on, because they're the ones that are going to be receiving these vehicles, and they're wondering where the ship is and, you know, what's going on. So, again, really, really early on in the process here, but, almost immediately they get, a guy named Robert Davis involved with this. And this is Mazda North America's Senior Vice President in product development and quality. And this guy will come up later on in the story as well. So Robert Davis is a main character at this point. But almost immediately, they're talking about salvaging this thing. You're like, what are we going to do to salvage this thing? Because the ship isn't sunk.
Right.
It's still usable.
Yeah.
But they've got all these cars on board. What are they going to do with them? And of course, that sends their mind reeling. Like, what's going to be the condition of these vehicles when we find them? They are strapped down well.
Right.
We know they didn't come tumbling out.
But still, you know, think of it the same way as flood damage, mm-hmm. right? And
yeah.
you know that flood damage will ruin a vehicle, even if it's brand new.
Oh, absolutely. And well, we'll get into this in just a moment here. I think soon, I hope. But,
yeah.
Well, actually, you know, there's still some more information to cover here. But we'll talk about what happens to these cars that they're not supposed to be at that angle for that long. Let's just put it that
way. That's another one, yeah. So, okay, this is something that's fascinating because it gets into the little known but immensely risky and possibly profoundly profitable business of salvage at sea.
Yeah.
So, there's a company out of Florida. They're called Titan Salvage. They were called in.
Yeah.
And they were going to be paid. The deal was, and it went through Lloyd's Insurance of London, a.k.a. the guys who will insure anything, including the posteriors of celebrities and stuff.
Legs of people on famous talk shows.
Right, right. Hands of pianists, whatever. They're down for it. They had this agreement for the insurance that said, okay, Titan Salvage, if you are able to save this cargo ship, you will have more than $10 million in your pocket.
$10 million. And you know what? There's something that was said just a moment ago that I can't let slip in.
Oh, man.
I have to say it.
What did I do?
I'm like a 10-year-old.
Oh, what? Kind of,
you said, hang on, I'll get this right. You said pianist.
Is it that how you're supposed to pronounce it?
I say it pianist.
You say penis?
I say it pianist. I know it's like a kid when I say it, but it's funny. I always chuckle when I say that word.
That's like, did you say crayon or crayon growing up?
I guess I said crayon.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You know, it's funny. When we moved here to the South, we had a friend that said the word crown, and I thought she was saying crayon because she was saying crayon. And I couldn't pick it up. I couldn't pick up what she was saying. Like her kid had to wear, it was her birthday at school or something, and she was wearing like this golden crayon. And I was like, what, a golden crayon? How's she wearing a golden crayon?
Yeah, it's strange. We got some pronunciation guides from some other people, not just in Australia, of course, but in different parts of the world. And one of the ones that I always remember is when I went to Massachusetts for the first time as a kid. There's a town in Massachusetts called Worcester. It is not spelled. Like, the spelling is, you know how, like, Chinese characters don't have anything to do with the pronunciation mm-hmm. of the word in Mandarin or Cantonese?
Sure.
That's how Worcester is.
Yeah.
And no offense to anybody who lives there. It's a great town, but this one guy pretty much called me an idiot, and I was a child at the time, mind you,
mm-hmm.
when he said, well, that's not the name of this, you know. It's like, hey, can you tell me how to get to Worcester or something? And he looked at me like I had just, you know, grown a pair of horns or something, and then or like just loudly farted or something, and then essentially said, you know, you knucklehead, but a much meaner version of that word, knucklehead, you're never going to get there because that's not a real place.
Oh, come on. Do a kid, he says this? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's not. That's unfair.
But pronunciations are important. And honestly, I can't believe you say penis.
Pants a penis, right? I can say that. That's a. Oh, all right. Let's move on. This is
okay. So Lloyd's will insure it.
We'll see if we keep that whole bit.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Lloyd's will insure anything, pretty much.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, yes, Titan Salvage does get more than $10 million if they pull off this rescue mission. But what happens if they fail?
Well, they get nothing. I mean, nothing at all. Not even a pat on the back.
Not even an attaboy and a sympathy card.
No, nothing like that. So it's big stakes for these guys, right? Mm-hmm. So they have to go in on board, and it's really dangerous what they have to do. They have to, you know, check out everything, and there's a lot of – I'll tell you, there's an article that that goes in depth into the salvage effort and everything involved with it. It's really, really, really well done, really well written. It's from a blog site called Wired.com, and I bet a lot of people know of the Wired site. If you search for a story called High Tech Cowboys of the Deep Seas, The Race to Save the Cougar Ace. And if you look up that that article, you will find a lengthy description of the salvage effort and everything that went on there. But just kind of a general version of it is that, you know, they had to go on board. They had to rappel down through the vehicles on, you know, using climbing gear. Yeah. They had to do a lot of really intense math calculations.
Only four of them.
Yeah, four people to figure out, you know, how much water it had taken on, how much they had to pump out, how much they had to add to certain parts of the tanks in order to right this thing again. Because the fear was that it was going to go the opposite direction. Like, the swing would be too great. Once they righted the ship, they knew they could do that, get it back up to, you know, on level.
Right.
The problem was, if they go a little bit too far, then that whole load shifts again the other direction, and with the water that they've just added, it could make it completely capsize. So it could go a complete swing the opposite direction.
Yeah, I like to think
and
of it
fast.
Similar to a kayak, you know, with shifting load.
Yeah.
Like, one of the first things they teach you when you're in a kayak is what to do if you end up upside down.
Yeah, yeah, how to right yourself, right?
How to right yourself.
But that can't happen in this case. And so it's really,
they get,
really,
like, one shot.
Yeah, that's it, and it's really, really dangerous. Now, I know it happens all kind of slow, but once it starts to right itself, there's a point where it would tip over fast, and that's the danger. So, again, that article that I just mentioned is something that will, if that type of thing intrigues you, you'll like that.
Yeah, so here's... You mentioned it earlier, Scott, and this is something I want to emphasize because this could be an action movie. So these four guys have to rappel in there. They have no light, but the light they bring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rappelling down in darkness like this is already going to be tricky business. But the thing is, as you said, they have to go past the vehicles that have been hanging in these straps. This is on June 30th, so this has been a while.
Yep.
And we don't know what the condition of those straps are because, you know, they're built to last, but this is an unusual circumstance. And the worst part is that if one strap screws up and if one car falls, depending on its position, it's, unless it's at, like, the very furthest side closest to the port, it could trigger a domino effect of all these other Mazdas falling. And death by Mazda avalanche is not the way most people want to go.
Oh, can you imagine? That would be awful. I mean, it would be like a pinball effect, I guess. You know, it would, or if, is that the right way to say it? Maybe not. Maybe, again, the avalanche is probably the best way to say it. But can you imagine if you were down there and they started to collapse on top of you? I mean, you wouldn't have more than a second to even think about it.
Yeah,
really.
You wouldn't even be able to say, like, well, at least they're not used cars.
Well, there were a couple of times in that article that I mentioned that they did accidentally step on a strap and it caused, you know, a creaking noise and a car to swing a little bit,
yeah,
and they were nervous and, you know, some tense situations. But
there was one
death that occurred, and it wasn't exactly what you would expect. It was a guy by the name of Marty Johnson. He was 40 years old. He was a naval architect, and he was down there to try to figure out how much water needed to come in and out of those tanks. And I guess he wasn't an experienced climber. And when they were departing the Cougar Ace for the tugboat that was over there to, you know, bring them back to the main ship, again, this is about a year after the initial accident. So this is like July 31st of the following year of 2007.
Yeah.
He fell when he was trying to walk across the top of the ship, the starboard side of the ship, and he fell 80 feet along the ship's stern. He hit his head on a stanchion, a bollard, on his way down. It's like a big post.
Yeah.
And so he had this, you know, major head trauma, and then he fell all the way down and he landed on one of the ship's winches that, you know, mm-hmm. brings in the lines. And I guess he lived a short time, but he died about an hour later. And again, that article that I mentioned mm-hmm. is about how they recovered him and, you know, tried to save his life. They tried CPR, et cetera. But it's a really interesting story. Tragic, but interesting.
And it's tragic. Another even more unfortunate aspect of him being the casualty is that, as you said, he was responsible for the model, which, you know, the math that you talked about, the equations they had to make in order to know how much water goes off and how much goes on and where and how and when.
And he was pretty accurate too.
And he was accurate.
Yeah.
So they had a senior naval architect, a fellow named Phil Reed, also working at Titan,
Well, he stepped in, right?
He stepped in and he looked at Johnson's original model and calculations. And then they prepped and they began actually pumping water in, water out.
And here's something we should mention right now is that this would have been far better off for Mazda had the ship just gone to the bottom of the sea. It really would have. Now, I mean, I know that the people involved, you know, of course, we want the people to get off, and normally they do in these situations. There's enough time for them to, you know, hit the lifeboats and get out and, you know, escape. But what I'm saying is, money-wise, I guess, if, let's say that everybody evacuated, it was all safe, and then the ship, you know, was
just
floundering around out there.
Or something.
Yeah, suddenly, like, just a little bit too much water came on board, and it just went to the bottom. It would be far better off for Mazda, because now they're stuck with, again, all these cars. There's 4,700 cars that are dangling by straps in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
And there's a rundown of exactly what was on board. They were all 2007 model year vehicles. If you want to get an idea of what was there, there were 2,804 Mazda 3s, 1,329 CX-7s, 295 MX-5s, 214 RX-8s, which, oh man, a lot of people would love to have those, 56 Mazda 5s, and 5 Mazda Speed 6s. So that's the kind of the rundown, plus the other 109 that we didn't know what, you know, the makes and models were.
Yeah, the mysterious top secret.
So, they kind of were, I guess, right? But so Mazda already is thinking about what's going to happen here, because a lot of people are calling Mazda saying, well, I wonder, I'm waiting for my new Mazda. It's not on that ship, is it? And they said, well, we can't answer 5,000 or let's say 20,000 people, because, you know, a lot of them weren't on the ship.
Right, right.
They, you know, the only 4,700 were on here. But so what we're going to do is we're going to post all the VINs on our website, you know, MazdaUSA.com. Mm-hmm. And if that VIN appears on your bill of sale, then, you know, that's one of the vehicles. And, you know, we'll have another vehicle. We'll have another plan in place, I guess. But a lot of people were really concerned that they were going to end up with a car that had been in the shipwreck. Mm-hmm. And not been told that it was in the shipwreck.
So here's, you know, I know, folks, that what Scott just said at the beginning might sound kind of counterintuitive, that it would have maybe been better for Mazda if the ship had sank. And because, here's why, and it makes sense. Mazda has insurance. Mazda would be able to say, well, that's a total loss. Thank goodness we have insurance.
Yeah.
But now...
A lot of it, by the way.
A lot of it, yeah. How much?
$103 million. So they would have had a nice fat check for $103 million. Instead, they're going to have to front the bill for doing something with these vehicles.
And these, okay, we have more information about the straps. These were nylon deck straps, right?
Yeah.
And when this when this cargo ship is listing at that almost 90-degree angle, what's happening is they're not just hanging there statically. They're moving with the current as the ship is drifting.
Continually stretching those straps.
Yeah, so 68 had already been damaged somehow. They'd all, between breaking free, getting banged up by cars that broke free and fell down, or suffering, you know, massive water damage, 68 cars already were in a bad way.
Yeah, exactly right. So, you know, they know that they've got this situation where they've got 68 that they're going to at least have to cover. They don't know the condition of the others. So what they start doing is they start testing back at the Mazda R&D department. They put some of these vehicles on jigs at that level, at that 70-degree angle, to find out what the effects are going to be. So what they were most concerned about at this point was the electrolyte and the batteries. They thought on the sides, you know, it's not all that bad, but with the added motion of the sea, as you mentioned, that kind of, they say salt shaker motion, I guess, that up and down motion, that can add a lot of damage to these vehicles. So they're concerned about the durability of everything from the seals and the powertrains that didn't have the lubricants that they're supposed to have to keep them, you know, soft. They're worried about, you know, electronic sensors and all kinds of stuff. The lubricants that, you know, are getting to places in the vehicles that they're not supposed to be in. And again, they're escaping areas that they should be in. So, so many concerns, really. And not just that, I mean, all the stresses that could be caused on the cars, the bodies, I guess, themselves, because a lot of them are the unibody design.
Right.
So, you know, they're not going to, or actually all of them are unibody design. So a lot of the damage that you couldn't see, I guess, was happening there as well, or at least they thought it was happening, because these straps are in, you know, they have tie-down hooks that they attach to the vehicles when they're shipping them. And so they're pulling on the cars with this immense force. You know, they're stretching, they're tugging, they're twisting.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a really, really bad situation. So when you start to think about, well, they can't just test on this angle, that 70-degree angle, they also have to consider that the cars were all parked at different angles on the deck. So some are going to be tilted to the side, some are going to be tilted backwards, some are going to be tilted forwards. It's this huge jumble of situations. Not only that, it's not the same make and model. It's not the same model.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would make a difference, you know, whether there's a Mazda Speed 6 there versus a CX-7 or something. You know, it's all different, between the different powertrains and the different positioning of them. There's so many different varieties of problems that could arise from this that it just totally confuses you when you think about it.
So they take the Ace to Portland, Oregon in September. They tow it there. That is the closest place that has repair facilities to get the ship up and running and also has enough room to park all of these poor, unfortunate Mazdas.
Yes, 50 acres of property. So they've got 50 acres of property, and they're going to park all these cars that look like they're brand new on this property, except for the 68th, of course, that tumbled free or whatever. But here's the weird thing that's happened. So customers are calling not only to check to see if, you know, their vehicle was on board already, you know, like the one that they already purchased, but they're also calling to say, hey, I heard you might have some cheap Mazdas for sale.
Can I get a deal?
Yeah, I want a deal, right? But not just them. And this is maybe one of the more interesting angles. Filmmakers wanted to buy them to wreck them in movies.
Yeah.
There were people that wanted them for trade schools, you know, for service training, which makes perfect sense, right? Fire departments wanted them to practice extractions in. People thought, you know, the MX-5s and RX-8s could go racing maybe. You know, they could be track day cars only. They'd never see the roads.
Never have to be road legal.
Exactly. And, you know, they're going to gut them anyways and put in whatever they wanted. So, but the problem with that was that eventually, some of those cars, there's a chance that they could make their way back out to public roads, if not the whole vehicle, parts of the vehicle. And Mazda, almost immediately, well, that Davis guy, he remembered, you know, we mentioned, what was his name, his first name, Davis, Robert Davis.
Uh-huh.
He's coming back into the story because he said there was like a 10-minute meeting that they had about this, and they almost immediately, unanimously decided that there's no way any of these vehicles could ever make it out onto the highways in any acceptable way for Mazda to be covered.
Just because of the various possible risks.
Exactly right. They had to completely destroy them so that not a single part of these things is ever going to exist. Now, there were a couple of exceptions. I think there were a few components that were sent to trade schools, I believe. And I think I've got a note on that in just a moment. But
they essentially decided to recycle all of them, right?
Yeah, there were a few dozen drivetrain components that went to trade schools, but every other part was completely destroyed. So this is, an unbelievably difficult decision for them to make, I'm sure. And in ways, you know, of course, they knew in their heart what was right. You know, they knew they had to destroy these so it didn't end up in somebody's hands and, you know, become a lemon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they also knew that instead of getting that $103 million insurance check, that they were going to be paying for the destruction of all these cars, and it was going to take years to do.
And they were taking a bath. Yeah. So the Ace arrives at Portland, right? We said in September.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost 2 years later, a year and 7 months later, when they had about 1,000 Mazdas that looked like they were ready to sell.
Yeah.
In these neat rows of four in one of these gigantic empty lots, they realized that they were recycling every single thing. And as Davis said, there's something you alluded to about the position of the vehicles just being on their side, in mm-hmm. addition to everything else we've talked about.
And what's that?
Well, it's that the reason they had to recycle everything, including the cars that were untouched and survived in their straps, didn't even taste the water, right? It's because their concern was that the salt shaker motion of the, that's the phrase you use, yeah, salt shaker motion of the ocean. That's a tough one, huh? Shaker motion of the ocean.
You got it.
All right. Took a few tries, but we got it. Anyway, that unique motion was messing with the electrolyte in the batteries and causing damage. And that's one thing they say worried them the most. So they had to recycle all of these, even the ones that look showroom ready, because as you had mentioned earlier, Scott, and as we had talked about earlier, when it comes down to it, there are certain things they would need to test that they just couldn't test. And, you know, you can't risk when you're already in damage control mode, you can't risk being the company that gets pinned with something like Mazda family of four dies in fiery auto wreck after Mazda sells shipwreck car.
Oh yeah, because that would happen eventually, right?
I mean, and they would never do that.
No, exactly. But they had concerns like all the airbags in these vehicles. They couldn't even crush them until they had deployed all the airbags. Now you wouldn't think that's a huge deal. You know, they could tear them out or whatever, but it's time consuming to tear them all out. So they found it a better solution to simply activate all the airbags at one time in any given vehicle. So they figured out these ways to do this. Now, they had a system set up where these guys would go around, and they did this for months on end.
A disassembly line.
Yeah, they would go from vehicle to vehicle, and they would trigger all these. Now, some of these, remember, have six airbags. So a couple of guys would walk around with like this little trolley system that had a car battery, a modified version of the electronic control module for each type of car that they encountered, and then a trigger box that was built by Mazda engineers in Japan. And this trigger mechanism could be plugged into just one main wiring harness, and it varied per by vehicle. But just for example, on a Mazda 3, the guys would pull out the center cup console, where the cup holders are. And they would access this connector. They would hook up the car contraption that they're carrying around. And then they would yell out, "Fire in the hole." And then they would ignite this, or push the switch, and it would ignite all of the airbags. Yeah, all six of the airbags would go off all at once. It would blow the windows out of the car. And then they're on to the next vehicle. And that was it. And one after the other, day after day, for months on end, these guys would do nothing but that. And that was like stage one of this whole process. The next thing that they would do then, stage two, I guess, would be when it was time for each of these vehicles to be crushed, because that was the not the end goal, because there's more to it than that. But stage two would be where they would bring each of these vehicles. They would kind of use this great big John Deere tractor to just really hastily pull them around in the lot, or lift them and place them wherever they needed them. Not much care given there, because why bother? Right. They're going to be crushed. It's like a junkyard car at this point. So they would put these up on a rack, and then they would drill holes in the fuel tank, the transmission pan, the brake reservoir, and then drain each of those fluids so that, those are completely removed. And then the wheels and tires were then removed, and each tire and alloy wheel got a half-inch hole drilled in them to prevent the reuse, so they would never be reconditioned in any way. You can't patch these holes that they would put
this
in them.
This is like the automotive version of sowing the ground with salt.
Yeah, it's exactly right. It's like there's no way they're coming back from this. And so then these steel wheels were then mangled in what they called almost like a log splitter, mm-hmm. I guess, for metal. And, of course, the lug nuts went into this big plastic bucket that would itself wind up in the trunk of a car that was headed for recycling, so those would be crushed. And just absolutely no part was to be taken off of these cars at all. But that's not the final step. There's still more to it than this. And you know what? We should take another break from our sponsor before we talk about that.
And we're back. So these cars are crushed, components are purposefully mangled, brought beyond the point of any use ever. And one by one, they're loaded into that overbuilt portable crusher.
Yep, exactly right. Well, there's a couple steps here.
Yeah, there's a couple steps.
Okay, so there's one thing that they would do is from the area where they were draining all the fluids and mangling them, really, they would then stack them in this truck that took four at a time, because they were just stacked one on top of the other. He would take them about a mile down the road to a place that was this big crusher, I guess. And the crusher was like another step in the whole process. The crusher then would use something like 2,400 PSI of hydraulic pressure to destroy or flatten the cars, rather. And then those were stacked five high and I think, 5 feet tall or something like that. It's a really short. They compact them very, very small. Very
at an operation called PCC, Pacific Car Crushing.
But that's still not the final step because down the road, they were loaded onto a truck, and then down the road, they went to a place called Schnitzer Steel.
And this is where we find out how much these vehicles ended up being worth.
Yeah, that's right. And these are all maybe based on speculation, I guess. These accounts,
are
right?
But at best guesstimates.
Yeah, this is what a normal vehicle, like a husk of a vehicle, would be worth. About $250. That's what the scrap value of the car is, that they're going to load into this device, this thing that this really cool thing that's just down the road from where they are.
You're aware of that show Pawn Stars. Have you ever seen it?
Yes.
This, to me, seems to be one of those, the best I can do is 250 moments.
I feel like that, too. They're making a pile of money on this because the scrap value has got to be worth more than $250. But that's what they're getting paid, or ballpark in that in that range. They won't say exactly what it was worth. But just down the road, on the Willamette River, is something called the Texas Shredder. And the Texas Shredder was the final destination for every single one of these vehicles. And again, you said it was like, it was an almost 2-year process to get all the vehicles into this Texas Shredder. But, this thing is incredible to watch. I've seen it in action, you know, on video. There's an online site that shows shredders in action. This one in particular is pretty bad. It's really, really cool. It's, a blue and yellow, they call it a blue and yellow monster that's so violent that Dante might have created a 10th circle of hell just for this device.
It is powered by a 7,000-horsepower electric motor housed in a, get this, constantly vibrating cinder block building.
That's right. It says that this thing has 26 1,000-pound hammers. They're made of manganese, by the way, that spin at 450 RPM and just shatter everything and anything into pieces no bigger than a clenched fist. And I've seen it working. I completely believe that, you know, no piece gets
it's
out of there.
It's frightening to see that thing in action.
But that's how Mazda assured that none of these vehicles were going to escape any of this. And none of them were going to end up on the road and, you know, become a liability for them, I guess.
And I highly recommend, I think I can speak for both of us here, Scott, we highly recommend that you check this out on the video. This thing, this monster is fed by three cranes.
it's constantly being fed material. I think, you know, it's one of those things where if it's running, it better be shredding something, right? I mean, because I bet it's so expensive to operate this thing that it probably is not worth it to have it on even for a minute if it's not really shredding something, doing some work.
Here's a weird thing, though, that I think gets a little philosophical, Scott, which is, all right, so after it's shredded, right?
Yeah.
You said there are pieces that are about the size of a fist at most.
Sure.
Then they're separated into ferrous, non-ferrous material, as you said. Mm-hmm. So 80% of the ferrous stuff goes to a steel plant in McMinnville, and it's recycled into rebar, stuff like that. But that other 20%, it's really interesting, it goes overseas, which means it is not likely, it is not plausible, but it is possible that that same material could be reincarnated in a way into another Mazda. I feel very Circle of Life right now.
that's a possibility. You're right.
It's not a probability. It's not a plausibility. Mm-hmm. It's just like a lottery ticket.
Yeah, it could. It could happen, I guess. And it would just be part of some component that you have in your vehicle. But it's an interesting thought still. I mean, really, it could. So finally, we're talking about, you know, May 6th of what, 2008 is when the final vehicle is going through this, the Texas Shredder. And, I don't know. This is a long tale to tell. I understand that. I mean, it's a long story, but there's more to it than we're talking about. You know, the salvage effort alone is twice as long as what we've described here today. I mean, there's a lot to that, and I really do encourage you to go check out that article on Wired.com. But I was thinking about this afterwards, after reading this whole story of how long it took and, you know, what it took. Oh, one quick note before we even talk about this. The Cougar Ace is back on the water again, and it's still shipping cars even for Mazda. It's still operational.
Right.
They got it seaworthy again, and it's back functional, and you know, so far so good. No problems since you know, it's been recommissioned.
Yeah.
So you know, we haven't heard it in the newspaper recently, so that's good news, I guess. But I was thinking about this, and I was wondering if this is maybe not the cheapest solution for Mazda. You know, they could have taken a different way out. They could have you know, sold the ones that weren't damaged as, you know, I guess maybe, could you still call it, could they be salvage titles? I don't know. In a way, they could have sold a lot of those as brand new vehicles still, I think. They could have gotten away with it. They could have said, we've inspected them, everything seems to work out fine. But it wouldn't have been the best thing to do. It wasn't the honorable thing to do.
Right.
And they did the honorable thing. They paid the whole bill for crushing and destroying these cars. It was years long in the making, but they did the honorable thing here. They made the right decision, in my opinion.
You know, I feel like they invested in their reputation.
Yeah.
So I don't see that kind of thing. So, and maybe that's why I'm not in charge of Mazda. But I don't see that kind of thing as losing money as much as I see it, that lost money, as an investment insane, you know, to consumers, to peers in the marketplace. This is saying, if something like this happens, which is, by the way, totally not our fault, we will do the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that...
it's admirable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word. I think it speaks very highly to the character of the company. There is one other thing, though, that I want to... It's barely related.
Okay. I also have something that's also barely related.
You have something? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'll go first.
Okay.
The idea of derelict or sinking or abandoned ships is fascinating to me. And it's been, you know, for a long time, braving the open ocean has been one of the most rewarding, dangerous, and strangest of human endeavors.
Treasure hunters.
Yeah. Treasure hunters, explorers, criminals, you name it.
Yeah.
I used to really, as a kid, be fascinated by stories of like the Mary Celeste, right? Or the legend of the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah. But, same here.
But what we forget is the ocean is, this is a family show, so I'll say it this way. The ocean is so frickin' large that things still get lost very easily. You want to disappear, go to the ocean. And it happens in the modern day. There was a Russian vessel built in Yugoslavia. It's called the MV Lyubov Orlova. And apologies to all our Russian listeners for my butchering of that. Have you heard of this one?
I have not.
It was built in 1976. It was taken out of service in 2010 and sat in Newfoundland for 2 years. They were trying to decommission it. But eventually, somehow, it broke free. And it just roamed the North Atlantic as a ghost ship.
Oh, no way.
And no one's really sure what happened to it. I think as of today, it's believed to have been sunk because people haven't seen it. But again, the ocean's so big. The ship has, you know, become kind of this modern legend. And, you know, we talk about the idea of expenses here. On February 28th of 2013, like, they just put out a warning. People just put out a warning for smaller vessels to say, like, hey, watch out for this Russian ghost ship.
This uncrewed ship
just floating around. And when I had heard about this, you know, one of the things I was thinking about immediately was, like, somebody should go get it and hop on it. But what they're doing, if they get that, unless it's legally salvage, is it stealing government property?
I don't know.
Is it legally taking on the responsibility for the expensive decommissioning process?
You'd be like a pirate.
Yeah,
at that point. Yeah.
Do you just live on it till it sinks? I mean, that seems kind of cool.
Yeah.
But the reason people feel that it may have sank is because it has a automatic kind of a dead hand system called an emergency position indicating radio beacon, or with the tremendously smooth acronym of an EPIRB. The Irish media said that they received a notice from this. Well, it was still in international waters. It's very important. But these kind of beacons turn on when the device is exposed to water.
Oh.
And this makes experts think it may have sunk, which I really hope didn't happen because...
Maybe like the thought of it just kind of floating around out there, like a ghost ship.
Right.
Because of the stories that you read when you were a kid.
Right. And so there are rumors that go around, but they're from less and less reputable places. So
yeah.
I don't know, but if you were out there and you have seen this ghost ship, please join me for a life on the high seas.
I like the thought that it's still out there, too. That's an interesting thought. I enjoy mysteries like that.
So what's yours?
Man, mine's not as exciting as yours is now,
don't
I guess.
Say that. But,
so I was reading a bunch of stuff, you know, and of course, one thing that I was reading was about all the cars that had, you know, gone off the side of the road into, you know, like these muddy creeks and stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, turned up bodies that had been missing for, you know, decades.
That blew my mind. Not all of those can be accidental.
Yeah, well, it seems like that, doesn't it? But there are, you know, numerous news stories of that. And so I read that, but that's not the only thing. I was also reading about cars that were in the Katrina hurricane here in the United States, and then they were bought by salvage companies.
Yeah.
And then not scrapped, but then they were sold to Latin America. So a lot of Katrina cars ended up in Latin America.
Now, oh, that's terrible, man.
I know it is, but it happened. And there were tales of people that had purchased, you know, specific vehicles that they knew came from these Katrina regions, and you know, that had been flooded over the roof line, and you know, they would pay, let's say they paid $7,000 for a new Mini that was, you know, a decent price. They knew there was something wrong with it. They knew that it was coming from a salvage company, so they didn't know exactly what had happened. And I think it said something like, the one example I read said something like there was water flow damage. And that's, this car was submersed for maybe a week, you know, or 2 weeks or more, you know, while this, the floodwaters receded. So that's an outright lie there. But, so let's say the guy bought it for $7,000. He would pay an additional, you know, $5,000, $6,000, or $7,000 to ship it down to Bolivia, and then in Bolivia they find out, well, there's some problems with it here. We're gonna have to clean this out. It's gonna be $13,000 in damages that we have to cover here. And then not only that, once you get that going, then there's more things that show up later on. You know, from the rust issues, and it just was ongoing. And they said that, you know, even so, this buyer in Bolivia of this one particular red Mini that I read about said that, you know, to purchase a brand new BMW Mini from BMW and have it shipped to Bolivia was still so expensive that this was still worth it to him to have to deal with all the headaches. Now, the headaches were, you know, that's something additional you would have to deal with the new car, but cost-wise, it was still cost-wise effective for him to buy a salvage vehicle and have it shipped there. So, again, I was just surprised to hear that any of the Katrina cars made it outside the United States, and we know we can track where they were, or where they are rather, and some of the problems that are arising from this even now, what, more than a decade later.
Yeah,
it's just an interesting thought. I thought all those had just been done away with. I thought that, you know, the word was out and everybody knew to watch for them.
Yeah, and we can't, this look, this is another excellent opportunity for us to emphasize that you should never, ever, ever, ever buy a flood damaged car.
No, it's a terrible idea.
Never do it.
No.
And this, you know, this is from a guy who's injured himself doing his own stunt work. So if I'm not even going to do it, then you certainly shouldn't do it either.
Sage advice, man.
Well, speaking of sage stuff, Sean, thank you so much for this excellent recommendation. Now, I know I feel like there's so much more that we could explore related to this. Ghost ships, the weird international unethical trade of flood cars.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be like we're like Interpol, but you know, for flood cars.
Hey, we haven't given Dylan his nickname yet.
We haven't.
Well, let's see. There's the Baltic Ace and the Cougar Ace. So, how about Ace?
Yeah, that's a good one, Dylan Ace Fagan.
Yeah.
And Noel Mazda Brown?
I don't know. That one still needs work.
No, Noel the Ghost Ship Brown.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's weird, though. How would you pull that? I think he's got the swagger to pull it off.
They call me the Ghost Ship. That's how you'd say it. You wouldn't say, I'm Noel the Ghost Ship Brown. You'd say, they call me the Ghost Ship.
Like, why? I hope you never have to find out. Anyway, take a closer look at this lake. Don't get out of the car. I'm kidding. Thank you guys so much for listening. We'd like to hear from you. What stories? I want to hear from anybody who has experience on the high seas. You know, naval experience, merchant marine experience,
salvage experience.
That would be amazing. And then also, you know, if you've just taken some weird cruises. I've never been on a cruise. I'm very curious about those.
Mm-hmm.
So you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Stay tuned for next week when we have a brand new episode coming out. And as always, our best ideas come from you. So if you feel so inclined, you can drop us a line where we are CarStuffHSW at the various social medias. And if you think that social media stuff is for the birds, for the sinking Mazdas, then cut it out entirely.
Inclined? I'm just not getting your joke.
Oh, I guess that does make sense.
Like the deck was inclined?
I did not get that one.
I know. I'm just probably making it up. I'm hearing things where there aren't things.
Well, this thing is not a rumor. This is a fact. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.